We are very happy to have Scott Melvin today that's going to tell us more about UV EFT correspondence for cosmology. The floor is yours.
Brilliant. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me. It's really lovely to see you all. Today, I want to give a kind of broad overview of some of the recent progress in using cosmology and cosmological observations to better understand fundamental physics. Okay, so this cartoon on the right hand of the slide is kind of showing the big picture idea. Basically, experimental searches for new physics are increasingly using an effective field theory approach, or EFT for short. The idea is that they fit their data using some effective phenomenological model of the low energy physics, which contains various free parameters that they can tune to capture small deviations from general relativity or the standard model. Now, what I want to know and what I want to tell you about today is what can measurements of these low energy effective parameters, what can they really tell us about the underlying high energy physics? Right. So, for instance, if there are new particles beyond the standard model with masses in a certain range, what is the possible large scale phenomenology that can result from those new particles? Right. And similarly, if the underlying small scale physics has a certain spin, or has other properties like if it's asymptotically free, so the interactions all turn off at high energies, what are the corresponding regions in this low energy parameter space? Okay, so I want to make a plot ultimately like this, but less cartoonish, in which I color in as many regions as I can according to what underlying UV property they are probing, right? And this kind of map is really important because it's essentially building a dictionary between what we actually observe on large scales and these properties of the underlying physics. So in this cartoon example, the data that I've drawn is inconsistent with the underlying physics being asymptotically free. So you've learned something very profound about how interactions behave at high energies, but it is broadly consistent with having masses in whatever range I picked and spins in whatever range I picked. Okay. So that's the big picture plan of what we'd like to achieve and why. So what I'll do is start with an introduction to effective field theory, which might be familiar to some of you, but not all. So this is my one slide crash course in what an effective field theory is and does. So this framework that we're going to be using for the talk today is ultimately a derivative expansion, which is used to capture the effects of high energy fields which cannot be directly produced at the energies that you're considering. Right, so if I start with maybe the picture on the right-hand side, this is the kind of schematic physics intuition for what's going on. The idea is if you're at very high energies, right, in the UV, so by UV I mean high energy, you have enough energy to excite all of the degrees of freedom in your system. If there's light fields and heavy fields, you can create them, they can oscillate in their potentials. But if you're considering very large scale physics, very low energy phenomenology, you just don't have enough energy to excite the heavy ones, you can only excite the light ones. And that means you can write down a much simpler effective description of your dynamics, which only involves the light degrees of freedom. So that's the physics idea. If you prefer equations, schematically what's going on is that the full quantum theory has both light and heavy fields. What I can imagine doing is path integrate over all the heavy stuff. So I'm going to average over all the heavy fields, and what I'm left with is some effective action, which only knows about the light fields. And what you find when you do this kind of procedure is that the effects of all that heavy stuff that you've averaged over is to generate an infinite series of effective interactions between just the light degrees of freedom. Okay, and each of these interactions comes with some coefficient, which is this CEFT in red. So these are the EFT coefficients. Now you might, looking at this equation, say, yes, well, Scott, what has that really bought me? I've written down now a horrendous Lagrangian that has an infinite number of terms. But the point is that at low energies, these derivatives are all small. So you can truncate this series and only keep the first few most relevant terms, and that is in practice what an experimenter wants as a template to go and fit to his or her data. So in principle, these EFT coefficients are determined by the underlying heavy fields that we've averaged over. But in practice, we do not know what this heavy physics is before we actually do the experiment which searches for it. So in practice, what we do is we take this general effective Lagrangian and we just use it as some model independent template to fit to data. We just treat these EFT coefficients as free parameters and hope that we can measure our system accurately enough to pin down the first 4, 5, 6 values and then try and resum the series to learn about the underlying heavy physics. So for instance, this is how searches for new physics beyond the standard model are increasingly being done. The idea there is to write down what's called the standard model effective field theory, which is basically the standard model, and then you add to it a series of non-renormalizable interactions that are built from standard model fields. So this is a description that only knows about the light degrees of freedom, the things you can actually create in colliders. And then you explain any small deviation from the standard model by fitting your data to some non-zero value of these EFT coefficients. And in cosmology, you can do something very similar. You could write down general relativity effective field theory, where you take GR and then you add to general relativity all of these interactions that you can build from the metric, the light degree of freedom in your system. These will be built from curvature invariants, and they each come with some undetermined parameter that ultimately you are going to fit to your data. Good. So with that overview out of the way, the technical question that I would like to ask is, suppose we actually measure one or more of these EFT coefficients, what does that actually tell us about the underlying high energy physics? If I only know the first one or two of these, then I've got no hope of actually resumming this infinite series. What can I do? How can I actually extract useful information from the one or two numbers that I might get in an experiment? So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to start by describing a very powerful set of UV EFT relations, which come from scattering amplitudes. And so this first part of the talk is going to be entirely on Minkowski spacetime, where scattering amplitudes are very symmetric and have lots of nice properties, and we can say lots of interesting things. And then I'm going to give a couple of instructive examples of how recently we've been trying to take that technology and extend and deform it so that it will also apply on cosmological spacetimes and use measurements of dark energy, large-scale structure, and inflation in the CMB to say something interesting about the underlying high-energy physics. And if there's time at the end, I might say a few words in way of an outlook, how we might do better than the bounds that I'm going to present today. And that'll really require going beyond scattering amplitudes. But we'll come back to that at the very end. Okay, good. So effective field theory is one of the pillars that we're going to be using today. And the other one is scattering amplitudes. So here is your one slide introduction to what a scattering amplitude is. Again, apologies if this is very familiar to some of you. The object that we are going to be considering for most of today's talk is the probability amplitude that you transition between two different two-particle states. So the picture is shown here on the right. This is your canonical scattering experiment. You create two particles from the vacuum in the far past. You let them go. They crash into each other some finite time. And then as a result of those interactions, they emerge with deflected momentum. Okay, good. And so this amplitude A, the mod square of this amplitude tells you how likely that deflection is to happen, a deflection from P1 and P2 to momenta P3 and P4. Okay. And now it's convention to factor out an overall momentum conserving delta function. And once you've done that, the counting of how many independent variables this thing can possibly depend on is not too hard to do. You might have thought that you had four vectors. That sounds like 16 possible components. But of course, on Minkowski space, you have all of this extra symmetry. You have Lorentz invariants and space-time translations, which is what enforces this delta function. And so when the dust settles, you actually can get away with only two independent Lorentz invariant variables, which we typically call S and T, Mandelstam variables. Now, I noticed there's a message in the chat. So maybe I can pause here and take the question from Lee.
So the question is, what if the new physics we are looking for is at very, very low energies, for example, at the scale of the cosmological field?
Yeah, fantastic. That's a good question. So yes, for most of what I'm going to say today, I have in mind that it's some new high energy physics, so physics that has some characteristic mass or length scale, which is much beyond the relevant energy scales for your observations and for your effective field theory. Now, there is some hope that what I'm saying today will also be useful in the kinds of situations that Lee has in mind. The idea there would just be that the way you build your effective field theory has to change. So more broadly, an effective field theory will work as long as you have some power counting scheme, some way of deciding which irrelevant operators you want to keep and which ones you want to throw away. And so you can imagine building some effective description of new physics at very low energy scales, but then the way in which you count and decide which to keep and which to throw away would be different. So right, what I'm saying now is I'm going to throw away ones that have lots of derivatives, because I'm imagining that at very low energies, those things are going to be very small. But if what you're interested in is very large scale deformation, then you might want some kind of inverse counting where you do keep ones that have lots of derivatives, because those are going to affect large scales. Yeah, so for most of what I'm going to say today, it's the high energy, heavy physics that we're interested in. Good. Now, this object, the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude, so the scattering amplitude between two different two-particle states, in terms of this object, the derivative expansion that I mentioned on the previous slide and sort of described in words just now, looks like a Taylor series expansion in these two variables, S and T. Right? The idea is that if you compute this scattering amplitude in your low energy effective field theory, you'll find interactions from the light degrees of freedom that you've kept in your description. And as a result of removing all the heavy degrees of freedom, you'll find an infinite series in powers of S and in T, right? Because for every derivative that appears in your Lagrangian, in the momentum space, that corresponds to a power of P or a power of S and T. Good. So this is maybe clearest with a very simple example. So imagine that you had some underlying high energy theory, which was very simple, and these light degrees of freedom could only interact by either exchanging a light degree of freedom with mass m or a heavy degree of freedom with mass big M. Right? If that's the only thing that can happen in your underlying fundamental theory, then this scattering amplitude is very simple. It's just two Feynman propagators, which look like 1 over m squared minus p squared. And the idea is that if you are a very low energy observer making measurements at energy scales S, which are much below the mass of this heavy field, what you can do is Taylor expand that propagator and write it as an infinite series in powers of S divided by this heavy mass scale. Right? In terms of diagrams, what you're doing is saying that rather than consider the propagation of these heavy fields, I'm going to replace it with some series of increasingly higher derivative interactions. All right, very good. Now, for the purposes of this talk, the interesting thing about this effective field theory expansion is what it's doing to this function A of S and T. Because in the fundamental UV theory, this is quite a simple function of S. In particular, it just has two simple poles coming from each of these Feynman diagrams. But when you go to low energies and do this derivative expansion, what you're doing is replacing one of the poles, the heavy pole at S equals M squared, with an infinite series. And this infinite series only converges within a finite radius. So your effective field theory picture looks something like the following. Your effective field theory amplitude is some good description of physics inside some circle of radius m squared, within which you can still see all of the light stuff, but you can no longer see any of the heavy propagation directly. Instead, you just see the EFT breaking down when you get too close to this mass scale. Good. Now, that's the simple tree level example, the simplest example I could think of. But it turns out that this is a much more general point, that in general, if you have some arbitrarily interacting field theory, you'll have not just tree-level exchange, but also loop diagrams, loops that contain the light degrees of freedom, loops that contain the heavy degrees of freedom. And so the high energy amplitude will look like poles and branch cuts from your light degrees of freedom plus poles and branch cuts from your heavy degree of freedom. But when you go to very low energies and you basically Taylor expand all of those heavy non-analyticities, they'll just become an infinite Taylor series in powers of S and N T. Now, the first key observation for today, and this is really the key observation on which the rest of my talk is going to be based, is that if the interactions in the fundamental UV theory are causal, and by this I mean a kind of microcausality, that these operators in your quantum mechanical theory, they commute at space-like separated points, then as a result, if you Fourier transform that position space statement into a momentum space statement, these scattering amplitudes in momentum space, they're analytic off of the real axis. So all of these poles and branch cuts that get generated always lie on the real axis and never anywhere else. So this is something which was proven rigorously for a massive scalar field by a number of people in the 1960s, a really heroic effort by a large number of people in the 1960s. And beyond a single massive scalar, there are some semi-rigorous arguments, some kind of hand-wavy arguments that causality does indeed always imply this analyticity. But there's a few loopholes when you go beyond a scalar. So what people often do in practice is promote this to an axiom, to an assumption. And you say, since this is how it works for scalars, I'm going to assume that for arbitrary fields, although I can't prove it as rigorously, I'm going to assume that the analytic structure is this, that the scattering amplitude is analytic off of the real axis. And the argument is ultimately that in perturbation theory, the diagrams that I drew here all have poles and branch cuts on the real axis and not anywhere else. And so you sort of say, assuming that that's a good description of my amplitude, that if I were to sum an infinite number of loops, I would still have exactly the same analytic structure. And the best place to read about this is in this classic analytic S matrix textbook from Eden and Company from the 1960s. Right, so these kind of foundational assumptions that underpin the S matrix program of the 60s. Now, why that's useful for my talk today is that these EFT coefficients, the things that we measure in practice, they can be extracted from this EFT scattering amplitude by doing an integral in the complex plane, right? In particular, I'm imagining doing an integral around some circular contour like this, which lies inside the radius of convergence. So my EFT makes sense in this white region, and I can integrate around a big circle. And if I integrate the amplitude divided by an appropriate power of S, I can pick out particular coefficients in this infinite series. Now, this key observation number one really buys me a lot, because what it tells me is that in this full UV theory, if I imagine doing the same contour integral of some circle of a finite radius, Cauchy's theorem tells me that I'm allowed to deform this contour in the upper and lower half planes because there's no poles or branch cuts there. So I can freely deform this contour, make it a really big circle, which wraps around the branch cuts on the positive and negative real axis. And this gives me an integral relation that connects the underlying UV physics. I'm now doing an integral which goes to arbitrarily high values of S, the energy, and it connects it to the coefficients that appear in my low energy effective field theory. So these kinds of relations are called sum rules. The idea that there's some low energy EFT quantity on the left, and it's equal to some high energy UV quantity on the right. And these kinds of contour arguments were known already in the 60s to people like Weinberg and Flossard and Martin. But this kind of effective field theory connection, recognizing that the left-hand side is just the EFT coefficients, that came around a bit later in the kind of late 80s in the context of chiral perturbation theory looking at pions. So what you should take away from this slide is that there's a kind of well-established way of connecting these EFT coefficients to a particular integral of the high energy scattering amplitude. So you might look at this box in red, and if you were one of these people in the late 80s, and you might say, what are these EFT coefficients really telling me about the UV? Well, they're telling me precisely the value of a particular contour integral of the high energy amplitude. Now, the modern twist on these ideas. Is there a question?
Yes, so I wanted to ask, if you don't know the UV physics, how do you know the radius of convergence of your theory, of your series? Because in principle, if you have to make an assumption on the UV physics, and then you know what is the mass of the degree of freedom, where your series stops making sense. But if not, how do you know that a priori?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So one thing which I'm going to do later in this very talk is precisely imagine that this mass is a certain value, run these arguments and derive some consequences, and then see whether those are borne out in data or not. And if they're not, it tells you that you were wrong about the mass that you guessed here at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then you can pick a different value of mass and do it again. And this is precisely that kind of first connection that I mentioned at the start. This is going to be the way in which the mass scale ultimately becomes encoded in these EFT coefficients. You can imagine running this argument for different values of where you do this contour integration. You can integrate over circles of different sizes. And then we'll see in a moment what happens when you assume that the EFT does converge. Will derive a consequence, and if that consequence is not in the data, then it means it doesn't converge there and the mass is actually lower than you thought.
Okay, perfect.
Perfect. All right, good. So the consequence that I was referring to just now is that these old arguments have recently been kind of revamped, given a new lease of life, by the realization that these contour integrals that you can do over some UV scattering amplitude, they can actually be written in a very transparent way. They can be written as an average over certain states in the high energy theory. So explicitly, if we introduce a momentum operator P and a rotation operator J, so these implement translations and rotations in the plane of the scattering process, then we can define the following average over all two particle states that have a total center of mass energy bigger than m squared. Right, so I'm going to, this equation here is defining what I mean by angled brackets in the rest of the talk when I write an expression like this left-hand side, where you just have angled brackets with no further clarification. What that means is I should integrate over all two particle states that have a center of mass energy bigger than m squared. And then whatever's inside the brackets, that's the thing that I should be sandwiching between those two particle states. Good. So this is the second key observation that we're going to make use of today. And it's the idea that if your time evolution in the underlying UV theory is unitary, then these UV contour integrals that came about because of causality, they're actually all writable, they're all proportional to certain matrix elements, certain high energy averages. So this has been used in a few different papers recently, but one of the more recent and one that explains this notation is this paper that I wrote with Joe Davidi and Tavon Yu a couple of years ago. And I'm not going to prove in too much detail where this comes from, but I can give you an idea of why unitarity is important. So the reason that unitary time evolution is what buys you this relation is that if you think about this complex energy plane, this branch cut is telling you that this function has different values if you approach the cut from above or below. If you approach the cut from above, you get precisely the matrix element that we used to define the original amplitude. If you approach the cut from the other side, you get some Hermitian conjugate of that. Now, unitary time evolution tells you that the Hermitian conjugate of your time evolution is not independent from the original time evolution. If 1 plus it, the thing that generates time evolution, is unitary, then it tells you that the difference, if I go above and below this cut, I'm looking at the difference of t and t dagger, and that's quadratic, that's t dagger t. So that's ultimately how these UV integrals become something that looks like a t dagger t with some operators inside. And the operators inside are just telling you about how many s and t derivatives you're taking. Good. So these two key observations are what lets me draw this cartoon that I promised you at the very beginning of the talk. The idea now is that if you assume that the underlying high energy physics, this UV theory, is causal and unitary, so it satisfies this sum rule, and then these UV integrals can be written as high energy averages, then what you find is that there are a number of constraints on these effective field theory coefficients. In fact, many of them are sign definite. And this sign definiteness in this matrix value notation becomes quite transparent because, for instance, if I look at the coefficient of S squared in my scattering amplitude, in this language of an average over high energy states, it's the average of 1 over p to the 4, and p is just some Hermitian operator, and I'm taking its average over a bra and a ket that are the same, so this has to be some positive number. So this is kind of the first of these positivity bounds that was written down in 2006. And then since then, they've been developed in many, many different ways, ultimately using increasingly imaginative properties of expectation values. So for instance, the next two that I've written down, and which I'll make use of a little later in the talk, is that if you take the difference or the sum of particular effective field theory coefficients, so coefficients of different powers of S and T, you can arrange for what appears inside this average to be sign definite, right? Something like p to the 4 minus m to the 4, that's sign definite because you're averaging over only the high energy states. And something like j squared plus p squared minus m squared is positive similarly because j squared is a positive thing and p squared minus m squared is a positive thing when you restrict your attention to high energy states. Good. Now, it would unfortunately take, I think, the whole rest of this talk to give a reasonable overview of all of the different developments that have happened recently in this direction. So here is a shockingly incomplete list of various papers that have come out in the last few years. The idea behind all of these advances, getting better and better constraints on this low energy parameter space, is essentially to come up with other conditions that need to be satisfied by particular averages. So, for instance, the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality is some nonlinear relation that averages of a probability distribution have to satisfy in order for it to be a well-defined probability distribution. And that gives you all kinds of interesting nonlinear constraints on these EFT coefficients. But we won't need those. Okay, good. Now, one comment that I want to make here is that these bounds are interesting phenomenologically, because now you can go and you can ask in any given effective field theory, how do my observations of these parameters compare with the region carved out by these UV assumptions of causality and unitarity? And in particular, perturbative string theory satisfies these two boxes, these causality and unitarity conditions. So the string theory swampland, I'm not going to try and work out the string theory swampland in this talk, but I'm only going to say that it should be contained within the region that is carved out by these positivity bounds. So if you were to find that you do very precise experimental measurements of these coefficients and you don't lie inside this positivity bounded region, then that is effectively saying that you don't lie within the string theory swampland, which would be particularly striking. Okay, so there's two questions. Let's go ahead from you read them out to me.
Yes, I was wondering if the part for region in the inside the green one in the EFT region corresponds to the landscape identified by swampland conjectures, or if there is a first principle computation from a string model that gives that part for region.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch all of it. Is there a way to come closer to the microphone and say it again?
Yes.
Sorry, thanks.
Is it better like that? Can you hear better with the microphone?
Yeah, try again.
Is it better like that?
It's okay, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so can you hear me now?
Yes, I can, thanks.
Okay, great. So I was wondering if, so you mentioned that string theory would satisfy the EFT constraints in terms of causality and unitarity, but I was wondering about like what precisely you mean. So is that the region, the landscape identified by Swan Plant conjectures, or is there a first principle computation from one specific string model to the string model where you see that the constraints are satisfied?
Okay, good. Yes, what I mean is, so far what I've assumed is that my low energy scattering amplitude can be extended to arbitrarily high energies in a way which is analytic everywhere except the real axis, and that on the real axis there are branch cuts whose integral is essentially writable in this way. It's ultimately a positive discontinuity. And both of those things are true in string theory, at least perturbatively. So I'm not making any claims about what happens in fully non-perturbative string theory. But in string theory, you can compute scattering amplitudes, which are analytic extensions of the low energy point particle amplitudes, which have both of these properties.
Oh, okay.
So since that's all we've assumed, in order to derive these bounds, then these bounds must also hold in string theory. That's
okay,
the kind of general nature of what I'm saying. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, cool. All right.
There is a question in the chat as well.
Yeah.
So Lee is asking, what does this say about the very high scale behavior? Is zero consistent with everything?
Oh, yeah, good. So the very high scale behavior, actually the next slide, I'm going to make a comment about that. So I'll answer that in a moment. Is zero consistent with everything? Is also a good question. So zero, if all of these EFT coefficients are vanishing, that basically means, for instance, you're just looking at GR, or you're just looking at the standard model. And so another way of asking your question, is zero consistent with everything, is asking, is GR or the standard model consistent with causality and unitary time evolution? And the answer is yes. So zero would be consistent with all of these bounds. But what's going to happen in a moment is I'm going to start to layer on more conditions that I want the UV to satisfy. And in particular, if I start to ask for properties up here that are not obeyed by general relativity or the standard model, like I assume that there's spins in a certain range that, you know, general relativity doesn't have, then I'll find bounds that don't include zero. Yeah, but that's a very good question. Yeah. So the reason that zero is going to be in all the plots that I show just now is that the GR and the standard model would satisfy these. Fantastic. So,
Lee, you are
final
muted.
Oh yes, go ahead.
Lee,
I think you are muted. It seems that you were saying something.
Oh, sorry. By zero, I mean everything is zero, not just general relativity, but we just break everything and have no scattering.
I thought you meant if these EFT coefficients are zero, like this origin here. I know, but you mean that if the scattering amplitude is identically zero?
Yes, everything just goes to zero.
Yeah, if it's zero at every energy scale, then yes, that I guess is like a completely free theory. Yeah, that's true. If you just write down some Gaussian field theory with no interactions, all of these scattering amplitudes are zero, and then all of these bounds are marginally satisfied. All of these things are going to be equal to zero. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, great.
Okay, very nice. So what I want to do now, this is the final thing that I'm going to say about the Minkowski story before changing gears and starting to talk about cosmology, is to start to flesh out this picture a little bit more about what different UV properties can you actually extract from these low energy coefficients. So one property which I didn't mention explicitly yet, and I ought to for completeness, is that there's actually another assumption which goes into these bounds, and that's that these high energy averages that I wrote down, they're integrals up to infinity, and you need to be sure that those integrals converge in order to make the argument I just made that the expectation of 1 over p to some even power should be a positive thing. That's only true as long as it's a finite thing. If it's infinity, then all bets are off. So locality is the thing that ensures convergence, and it converges as long as you have 1 over p to a power that's greater than 4. But with that in mind, you could ask, well, what if the theory is not just causal and unitary and local, but is also asymptotically free? So if it's asymptotically free in the language of the scattering amplitude, it means that at very high energies, the amplitude goes to 0. And it turns out that's enough for these averages to converge also for 1 over p squared. So something that we did recently is ask, in that case, how can you tell what could you measure in your low energy EFT to distinguish between high energy theories that are asymptotically free versus ones that are not? And so we came up with this. This is just one proof of concept. This is one proof of principle. If you scatter two spin half fermions at low energies with opposite helicities, that scattering amplitude in the low energy EFT has a piece that's linear in S and a piece that's linear in T. And if you run these arguments to express the coefficient of T in terms of these high energy averages, you find that it's a sum of two terms that are both positive as long as 1 over P squared converges. So what you can conclude is that if the theory is asymptotically free and these 1 over p squared averages are all nicely converging, then this coefficient has to be a positive number. If you were to measure this coefficient and find that it was negative, either you give up on causality, unitarity, and locality, or you appeal to this loophole that maybe it's just that these things are not converging properly, and that would be compatible with locality. So this is proving that there are regions in low energy parameter space, which if you're outside of, you can conclude that the underlying theory could not have been asymptotically true. Then something very interesting happened. So there's a really incredible paper that came out shortly after, in which they went farther and said, okay, what if the theory is asymptotically free? So this 1 over p squared, they all converge. What if we then split those high energy theories into ones that are dominated by spin zero fields and ones that are dominated by spin one, by vector exchange? Could we tell the difference? How would we know if we just measure low energy effective scattering? Right, this is like a four Fermi interaction. Suppose you didn't know anything about the W and the Z boson and you were trying to work out its spin. Could you do that? And what Grant Remen and Nick Rod showed is that you can. So they again showed that for scattering fermions, this time with the same helicities, if they're identical fermions, it turns out coefficient of S and T are the same. So there's just one EFT coefficient at this order. And it's actually given by the difference of two terms. So a term which is J equals zero dominated and a term which is J equals one dominated. And so what they concluded is that actually, if your UV theory, if the states which are mediating the scattering that dominate this average, if they have spin zero, then this EFT coefficient will be a positive number because this first term is bigger than the second term. However, if the opposite is true, if it's these vector exchanges that are dominating the scattering, the second term dominates and this number is negative. So what they're moving towards is basically saying that you can make this map very interesting of your low energy parameter space. There's now regions where if you land, you can say something concrete about whether the spin has such and such a value in the high energy theory. Okay. So this is the kind of big conclusion of this Minkowski part of the talk, that the signs of these EFT coefficients can probe properties like the mass, the spin, and the high energy growth of the underlying UV theory. And these are the examples that I've mentioned today, the ones that we've started to work out how to do. The hope is, of course, that in future, by being more creative about the things you assume about the UV and working out how it would constrain these averages and therefore these EFT coefficients, we might populate this graph with more and more colors, identifying more and more high energy properties. Are there any questions or thoughts at this stage before I change gears and say a few things about cosmology? No? Okay, good. So for the next kind of 10 minutes or so, I want to give a couple of examples of how these bounds can be applied in cosmological field theories. And the first example I'm going to give is an EFT which describes dark energy. Now, the first question that I should address is these previous relations that I described for Minkowski scattering amplitudes. If you look closely, they all require time translation invariants. Because if I were to be a bit more explicit about what these averages actually are, I'm using a two-particle state that was created in the past and a two-particle state that was created in the future. Those are my asymptotic states that I'm scattering between. And now if I don't have time translation invariants, the energy is not conserved, then the vacuum in the past and the vacuum in the future need not be the same. Okay, so I could still imagine writing down a similar kind of relation, but these things are no longer going to be sine definite. They're no longer going to be positive. So in that case, how can we apply this machinery to cosmology? Because in cosmology, almost by definition, the background of all of your fields breaks time translation invariants. You want a space-time which is expanding in time, for instance. So I'm going to describe via two examples, dark energy and inflation, two different strategies that we've come up with for trying to take these Minkowski bounds and apply them in cosmology. The first strategy is arguably the simplest, and that is to just imagine an effective field theory that has both a Lorentz invariant Minkowski background solution and a cosmologically relevant lambda CDM-like solution. So then this kind of schematic picture shows what we're going to do. We're going to find such an EFT, okay, which looks like GR plus corrections. And by expanding this theory around its Minkowski solution, we can scatter fluctuations around that background, compute a Lorentz invariant scattering amplitude, run all of the arguments that I just described, and place bounds on the parameters that appear in this EFT. Now we have an EFT with bounded coefficients. So we can return to that theory and now expand it around a different background, expand it around this cosmological solution. And those fluctuations around the cosmological background are the things that we have observational constraints on. Okay, so on the next slide, phi is going to be like a dark energy field, and we can measure how dark energy shapes large-scale structure in galaxies. So we have observational ways of constraining these EFT coefficients. And then we can compare the two, right? Then we can ask, how do these observational constraints we're getting around this background, how do they compare to the positivity bounds you would have inferred if you had expanded around the Lorentz invariant background? Good. So to make that concrete, here's a particular EFT that people use to describe dark energy. It's called the quartic Horndesky theory. If you like, the way to think about it is, it looks like the Einstein-Hilbert term of GR, but you've replaced the Planck mass with some function of X, where X is the kinetic term for a new scalar field phi. And then there's a term that looks like the cosmological constant, but now it's not a constant, you've upgraded it to a function of the scalar field phi. And then there are a particular second derivative interaction, which is added to make the whole thing ghost-free. Now, in the context of this scalar tensor effective field theory, which has been widely studied from a phenomenological point of view. So in particular, if this scalar field phi is to describe dark energy, then it can provide a background expansion, which is essentially indistinguishable from lambda CDM. What it does is affects how fluctuations propagate on that background. So relative to lambda CDM, there's kind of two key differences. The first is that if you have a gravitational wave, a very low energy gravitational wave propagating through this background for phi, so phi has some time-dependent background, which basically acts like a medium, has some effect of refractive index, it can change the speed of your gravitational waves, but without changing the speed of light and other matter fields. So it can affect the relative speed of gravitational waves with respect to light. The second big difference is that these self-interactions mean that there are fluctuations in this dark energy field. So it's like there's fluctuations in the cosmological constant, and these fluctuations can move around and they cluster together because of these interactions. So those are the kind of the two big differences. The clustering is parameterized by this CB. And here I'm showing the current experimental constraints from large scale structure, the matter power spectrum, things like BAO and redshift space distortion in the early universe, and CMB. So this is the 1 and 2 sigma confidence intervals that we have on these two parameters, the speed of gravitational waves and the rate at which dark energy clusters together. Now, crucially, in these models, this P of X, this is really the thing that controls the background evolution. And what's often found is that once you demand that you have a lambda CDM-like background, you typically find that you need a P of X that has this kind of shape, that has multiple minima. And some of those minima are Lorentz invariant. There's the minima that you want, which are the ones that are these cosmological lambda CDM-like solutions, but they come with nearby Lorentz invariant minima, right? So this fits the bill for the strategy I just described. We can compute amplitudes around one and compare it to this kind of phenomenological data, which we have around the other. Now, the asterisk here is to say that there are a few notable exceptions to what I've just said. There are a handful of theories of this form which don't have any Lorentz invariant vacua, for instance, these ghost condensate models. And I'm not going to discuss them now. You'll see when I give the second inflationary example how we would deal with that kind of model. So effectively, what I'm doing for this plot I'm about to show is I'm adding to my list of UV assumptions, causality, unitarity, locality, and the existence of this nearby Lorentz invariant vacuum that I can compute amplitudes around. But now with that extra assumption, I'm in business. I can compute, for instance, the scattering amplitude between a dark energy fluctuation and a photon, right? And these things don't couple to each other directly, but they both gravitate. So the scattering amplitude is mediated by the metric. And at low energies, it's given by this G4 prime times S squared. But now G4 prime is this parameter that controls how the speed of gravitational waves gets affected by the phi condensate background. So what I can do is I can compare, right, this amplitude that I've just computed with this phenomenologically relevant parameter, the speed of gravitational waves minus one, because this thing is proportional to G4 prime plus small time-dependent corrections, which I've now shown is equal to the second S derivative of some amplitude, which by all of the Lorentz invariant arguments I just made is equal to a positive expectation value in the high energy field. So the conclusion from doing this strategy in this model is that any UV theory that ticks all four of these boxes should land you in the upper half of this parameter space. Should give you a value for your low energy gravitational wave speed, which is bigger than one. So that's perhaps unexpected because one in these units is the speed of light. And so to say this in words, it's really saying that low energy gravitational waves must propagate superluminally. So, the first comment is that one way to think about what this is saying is that in the high energy theory, very high energies, you restore Lorentz invariance and the speed of gravitational waves and matter and photons are all equal to one. Everything travels at the same speed because you have a beautifully Lorentz invariant theory. But when you zoom out and look at low energies, you start to see the effects of the background expansion and you break Lorentz invariance, and now the fields can travel at different speeds. And in particular, what happens as a result of integrating out heavy fields is that your matter cone, the sound speed of your matter, always has to shrink. It has to go inside your gravitational cone if the theory is to be causal and unitary. And when you say it this way, it doesn't sound too surprising because really it is the speed of gravitational waves. It's the cone of the metric, which is really linked to causality and to whether operators should commute outside of the gravity cone or not. Matter are just kind of spectator fields that don't affect the causal structure of anything. Good. The other comment is that here I'm showing cosmological constraints on the gravitational wave speed, but I'm not showing constraints from experiments like LIGO and Virgo terrestrial gravitational wave observatories. And you might ask why. And the reason is that from a cosmologist's point of view, what LIGO measures is the speed of gravitational waves at a very high energy, measures the gravitational waves at a frequency of about 100 hertz, which in these dark energy models, these Horndeske type models, that's perilously close to the scale at which your EFT breaks down, at which you expect there to be some new degrees of freedom. Because if you change this cutoff, you change your EFT's breakdown scale too much, you can no longer accommodate a nice lambda CDM-like expansion and be consistent with experimental data. So this is why, from the point of view of the arguments I'm making here, these are cosmological constraints on the very low energy gravitational wave speed, by which I mean gravitational wave speeds that are much, much lower than 100 hertz. And so LIGO is kind of almost measuring like a UV thing. LIGO's almost proving that this picture, the top half of this picture is good. And what this plot is doing is asking about what happens in the bottom half of this picture. All right, fantastic. So the final thing I want to say about this dark energy model is that the bound I've just written is necessary but not sufficient, because I just looked at one particular scattering amplitude, scattering a dark energy fluctuation against a photon. But there are lots of other scattering amplitudes that I can consider. For instance, I could scatter two dark energy fluctuations against each other. And I can compute in my low energy EFT, what is this amplitude? In this case, it scales like S squared times T multiplied by some coefficient. And I can do the same game. I can compare this with these phenomenological parameters, the clustering and the gravitational wave speed. And what I find is it's this particular combination of CT and CB, which is proportional to this S and T derivative of a scattering amplitude, and therefore has to be positive. It's related to some UV average, which is a positive thing if the underlying theory is unitary and local. So I arrive at a second bound, which changes my picture on the lower right to something like this. It isn't just the gravitational waves are superluminal, but you also get another line here coming from the phi phi to phi phi scattering. And this is starting to look very interesting. This is starting to say that if you have these conditions on your high energy theory, which remember we're all satisfied by perturbative string theory, then you can only ever land on large scale phenomenology that live in this upper left hand corner. Now, of course, the current data that we have has fairly large error bars. This is like 1 and 2 sigma confidence intervals. So it is consistent with general relativity at about 2 sigma. And it's consistent with these positivity bounds at similarly, you know, kind of 1 point something sigma. So I wouldn't say that there's like an experimental tension with these UV axioms. But what is very exciting is that next generation experiments are forecast to improve these confidence intervals, these error bars, by a factor of about 10. So of course, we don't know where the central value is gonna shift to. This is me just making a provocative plot in the lower right-hand corner. Imagining the central value doesn't shift and all that happens is the errors just get shrunk by a factor of a few. Then we'll, in a few years' time, have a plot that looks like this, which starts to be very interesting. It says that, now there is some tension between these amplitude considerations, these what seem like fairly natural things to assume about the high energy theory, and then what we're actually measuring in our large scale structure. Now, I gave a version of this talk a couple of years ago when these papers first came out. And of course, people asked the very natural question, what if that happens though? What if the central value jumps and the error bars go down and you learn that the data is perfectly consistent with all of these bounds that you have? What do you learn there? Do you learn anything? And this is why this recent shift in thinking about how can we add in additional high energy properties and derive additional low energy constraints starts to become really useful. Because in this particular example, if you use these spin dependent bounds that I mentioned a moment ago, and assume, for instance, that not only does the UV tick all four of these boxes, but it's also dominated by scalar exchange, by states that have a total spin zero, but then you find that this, these two bounds get even stronger. And in fact, the region of parameter space in which you could be dominated by scalars is the lower part of this green region. And so, okay, if next generation experiments are actually somewhere up there, that would also be amazing. It would be telling us that if you're looking for UV theories that are dominated by scalar exchange for these particular scattering processes, then you're out of luck. You're never going to be able to build a UV model which ticks all of these boxes and matches data. Of course, you could then ask, well, what happens if these error bars end up, you know, inside all of these different bounds? And then I would say, well, I'll just come up with some other condition that the UV could satisfy and draw more colors on this plot. And this is now an iterative procedure where data is going to keep getting more precise and theorists are going to keep getting more imaginative. And this is a new way in which we can start to home in on particular UV properties that the underlying field theory might have. Now, I'm aware that it's about 5 minutes past five. I don't remember exactly how many minutes late we started. So I had one final example, and this is thinking about inflation and the early universe, but maybe could I check how I'm doing for time and whether it's a good point to stop for questions now, or whether I should go ahead and do the final 4 or 5 minutes.
You have 5 more minutes.
I have 5 more minutes. Time.
Yeah, but you can do it and we can keep the question for like after. So you can.
Yeah. Okay, yes, perfect. Yeah, if that's okay, then I'll spend 5 minutes and explain how you might apply the same technology for correlations in the cosmic microwave background. And now the idea here is to start to develop a new strategy which goes beyond this vacuum hopping. So the dark energy story was that if your EFT had multiple vacua, then you could do scattering around one and observations around another and try and compare them. Now, when we write down effective field theories for inflation, often this is not the case. We have a rapidly expanding quasi-de Sitter space-time, and generally we write down an effective description for fluctuations around that rapidly expanding background. And it's very unlikely that you're going to have a Lorentz invariant background anywhere nearby. So in order to apply these kinds of ideas, we needed to develop a new approach. And what we came up with is this. So on quasi-de Sitter spacetimes, it turns out the scale at which you break boost invariance and the scale at which you break time translation invariance are very different. There's a parametric separation, which is the slow roll parameter for inflationary people, which separates these two scales. So if you like, this is my cartoon on the right showing how this works. If you scatter fluctuations with very high frequencies, very high energies, frequencies much bigger than both of these symmetry breaking scales, then you're basically in some effective flat space limit. You can compute scattering amplitudes as if you're on flat space. This is effectively what happens at the LHC, right? I mean, like you're colliding things that have energies way higher than whatever the Hubble rate today is, so you don't care about the background space-time expansion. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have scattering where the energy of the particles is much lower than the scale at which time translations is broken. And what that means is by the time these particles have found each other and started to interact and then gone out again, space and time have dilated by a significant amount. So in particular, these things no longer travel on straight geodesics, they travel on curved paths through space. And it's actually very difficult in that case to construct an S matrix and a scattering amplitude. But thankfully, when you're talking about quasi-de Sitter spacetimes, there's a separation between these two regimes. There's kind of a sweet spot in the middle where you scatter fluctuations in what's called the sub-horizon regime, where they have energies that are high enough that they come in and interact with each other and go out again before space has actually dilated by too much. So they don't feel any violation of time translation invariance, energy is still conserved. but they do know about the breaking of boosts. And the reason for this is it's a bit like what happens if, imagine you were surrounded by a fluid, a fluid with a static energy density. There would be a preferred rest frame. If you tried to boost, you would notice that the fluid around you is now moving. But there isn't any violation of energy conservation or time translation invariance because the energy density in the fluid doesn't change with time. So that's kind of what's going on here in this picture in the middle. Now that leads to two differences with the Minkowski story. If you scatter fluctuations in this sweet spot in the middle, then what you find is that energy is still conserved, but now boosts are broken. And what that means is if you think about how particles propagate, their kinetic term in the action is no longer phi dot squared minus two spatial derivatives. Now there can be a sound speed, which is different from one. And so it's convenient to call that combination some new effective metric. So this is diagonal and it looks like one minus CS squared minus CS squared minus CS squared. So this is kind of now telling you about the cone on which these fluctuations are going to propagate in this sub-horizon region. The other thing that happens is that at the very beginning, I said that, oh, because of Lorentz invariance, the amplitude only depends on two variables, S and T. Now you've broken three symmetries, so the amplitude can depend on three further things. So it's convenient to take, say, the energies of three of the particles, and the energy of the fourth one is fixed by energy conservation. Now, what we showed with a PhD student, Tanguy Grahl, more than a year ago now, is that you can run an analogous argument for these scattering amplitudes, these sub-horizon scattering amplitudes. Okay, these two differences need to be taken into account. So in particular now, rather than thinking about a complex S plane, it makes sense to think about a complex S-twiddle plane where S-twiddle is constructed using this effective metric, because now causality is all about whether things commute with respect to this G-twiddle. That's what determines the cone of propagation for these fields. And what we find is something very similar, that we were able to kind of repeat the rigorous S-matrix arguments only in a certain range of theories. So for real scalar fields that have a certain range of sound speeds. But in perturbation theory, it's actually analytic for any sound speed. So then we say the same words. We say, okay, we've rigorously shown it in some region. And then in perturbation theory, it's actually analytic in a larger region. So we make this assumption that perturbation theory is actually capturing the true analytic structure of this object. But then you run the usual Cauchy theorem arguments, right? The same picture that I showed you at the beginning. And what you find is that the coefficients in this EFT are again some average over high energy states. Now it's not just 1 over p squared, it's p's contracted with this effective metric. So the final thing that I want to show you today is what that actually means for the data that we have collected from the Planck satellite about the correlations in the cosmic microwave background. So the effective field theory, which is used by Planck and other collaborations to fit cosmic microwave background correlations, was written down in 2007, and it involves a scalar field pi, which, if you like, you can think of it as the temperature fluctuations in